Welcome to A Lust for Life's new parenting podcast series. I'm your host, Kira O'Connor-Walsh. A Lust for Life is a mental health charity on a mission to educate and empower the children and young people of Ireland through early prevention mental health programmes, content and advocacy. And we also want to support the adults in our children and young people's lives, parents, teachers, guardians and friends, by giving you the tools that you need to be that one good adult in a child's life. And that is what this podcast is all about. So join us as we explore the joys and challenges and complexities of parenthood through compassionate conversations, interviews and real-life parenting stories. We're here to provide you with practical tips, support and resources to help you parent with a little more ease and to nurture both your child's and your own mental health. Thank you so much, Michaeline, for joining us here today on the Lust for Life Parenting Podcast. Michaeline is the author of New York Times bestseller Hunt Gather Parent. And this book describes a way of raising helpful and confident children, which is what we all want, both helpful and then happy. And also using techniques and ways of parenting that have been around for thousands of years. And it kind of explains as well how we in the West can learn from, non-Western approaches to parenting and Indigenous parenting ways, life ways, really, isn't it? It's not here's top five ways of doing it. It's like a really a way of life. And you wrote this book after traveling around three continents with your then three-year-old daughter. And you are also a global health correspondent for NPR's Science Desk. And you report about disease outbreaks and children's health. You're a Peabody Award-winning science journalist. Did you ever envisage yourself being a New York Times bestseller parenting expert?
No, not at all. In fact, it was I was convinced to write this book by a book agent. I wanted to write a different book, and he was like, "You have to write a parenting book." And I was like, "No, this is the last thing I want to do is write a parenting book." You know, parenting is very sensitive, and people get very upset and have lots of opinions, and even the science is very messy. The science is a hot mess. And, but you know, after traveling for work a bit, I started to try some of the things I was learning from parents in different parts of the world. And they just worked so well with my little girl that I was really like, I have to write this because this is going to help people. And I want to help people because you actually don't need to do a lot of it to see some really big changes, I think, in your children. At least that's the impression I had with my little girl. And then it's been 3 years since the book came out, and I get emails about that all the time. So it's not about changing everything. You don't have to change everything. It's really about a couple of ideas about children and your role as a parent, and just trying some things and seeing how the child responds to them.
Yeah. And just before we get into the book itself, something that you describe at the beginning is this frustrating cycle of like trying and failing different strategies and going, oh, you're kind of going around in circles. But these sort of parenting strategies can sometimes be in a vacuum. You're just trying this random idea that you read about on Instagram or something, not actually to do with the way you live. It's just like, maybe if I try setting a clock, you know, or kind of like little strategies that then your child isn't going to respond to them because they don't have any depth. You know, they're just...
I think I've been thinking about this a lot. I'm working on another book right now. And I think a lot of the parenting ideas out there, they probably work in moments, you know, or at a certain time in a child's life or with certain children. But I don't think they have like kind of, they're not based on kind of this global view or this value system, right? Like what do you actually want to teach the child? What, you know, like, what is the value you want to transmit? And I think for a long time, I thought I had these values and then my actions reflected these values. But I think more often what we're teaching children to value and what we think is important are based on these actions we do that we're not even like aware of, you know? And so I think a lot of the parenting advice out there right now is like, there's not, like you say, a depth to it because it's missing kind of an overarching structure and value system. And this is what I think a lot of, you know, the Irish have had this, you know, when I was studying this, I'm of Irish heritage and I was reading a lot about ancient Irish parenting, and, you know, and a lot of the tools in the book, you know, were in Ireland not that long ago, 100, 200 years ago. You know, these are tools that parents in the West have used too, because all parents want to raise helpful children. You know, all parents want to raise confident children. And so there was like this very kind of structure in place that parents use to transmit these values, to transmit helpfulness, to transmit confidence and good mental health. And I think that's what we've lost, is this kind of, okay, we have these goals and we have these tools that support these goals. You know, it's not just about like stopping the tantrum in the moment or just, you know, getting the kid to clean up after dinner right now. These are things we're teaching over like a long years and years, and, you know, and building this relationship with the child. And I think that's what's missing in our parenting advice today, are these really kind of like, okay, I'm doing this because I want to teach my child this.
Yeah.
You know? And so if you think then about that, it's like, okay, why would you yell at a child then? Because it's like, okay, you're teaching the child to yell if you're yelling, right? I mean, not that, you know, every parent yells at some point, but, you know, over and over again, if you're yelling every day, and that's the way you get the child to do something, then in the end, you're teaching the child to yell, right? So it's like thinking a little bit more about how our actions affect children's views over the long, you know, affect what children learn is important to the family and to into their life.
Because I think in parenting, you're so caught up in the moment, but actually, you know, just trying to zoom out and see it as a way, you know, like, how am I going to be with my child? Conscious decision rather than just acting in the moment out of that, like, irritation about, you know, a small thing.
Yes. And I think, you know, our ancestors, they were really smart when it came to children. They were really smart. They had generations and generations backing their ideas. And I think, you know, in those moments, they had these tools. And I talk a lot about them in the middle of the book, these tools that do work, but they also support this value, these values, you know? And I think that's kind of what we've lost. You know, I talk a lot about in the book about how we've lost the teachers of parenting, right? Like, we used to live with older generations, or we would be around them. They'd be the neighbors. They'd be, you know, they would be part of our everyday life, right? And they were teaching the younger generation how to parent. And that's where these tools were like passed down. And now you're right. Now, you know, for a few hundred years, Western society has been using parenting experts. But even like 150 years ago, 200 years ago, they just kind of randomly grabbed things and said, this is what works and this is what you should do. And there was no science to back it. And a lot of those ideas are still in our parenting, the parenting literature. But now we have social media, right, where people just randomly take things and just stick them in and say, do this, you know. But I think that if we look back to our ancestors, we're going to find much more effective tools that have been tested and tried for, you know, thousands of years.
Well, I have a theory as to why this book has gone so gangbuster is good for you, because I think something that we're really missing is that community to teach us how to parent. But what I'm finding with a lot of my peers is that we don't want to parent in the same way as we were parented ourselves.
Because our parents were missing these tools, right? And so like we've gone now, I mean, we really lost this way of parenting, like post-industrial revolution is where it really started to change fast. And so our parents were raised with this very strict, very authoritarian way of being. And none of us want that, like, right? Like none of us want to be yelled at and punished like that. And it's like, well, what do you replace it with? You know, and when I've been at NPR for almost 13 years. And I traveled a lot for my job. And, you know, I really started to see in many, many cultures that parents weren't struggling the way we struggle. Like there wasn't this like constant struggle to get kids to do just very simple things, you know, make their bed, clean up after the kitchen, be kind to their siblings. You know, they're just be kind to the parents. There just wasn't this kind of constant struggle that I was having. And I also saw, you know, in San Francisco. And so I really started to see like there's a we're missing big pieces of this parenting puzzle, and it's actually not that hard to fill it back in if you understand a few things about children and kind of change your mindset a little bit on children.
Okay, well, let's get into the book then. In the book, you set out with your 3-year-old daughter in tow, so super brave for starters, to travel
yes.
around to 3 different communities that you selected. So the Maya families in Mexico, Inuit families up above the Arctic Circle, and the Hadzabi families in Tanzania. You kind of looked beyond the parenting manuals and just watched. What is the
yes.
essential truth in these communities as to how the parenting models have been passed down from generation to generation? And
Yes.
I think there was a lot of commonalities. Let's maybe start out talking about the Maya method. One of the things that stood out for you with that community is that their kids were so helpful and flexible and cooperative, and they wanted to help, and there wasn't this like push-pull that we find.
Yes, that's right. And this has been well documented in research that Indigenous communities in North America raise these incredibly helpful kids. And you said the right word, they want to help, right? This isn't like they feel like they have to help. They like want to help. When the first trip I went on it there, I was talking to a mom in her kitchen in the morning, and her little girls were on spring break, and the 12-year-old woke up, you know, she got dressed, she came into the kitchen, walked past me and her mom, and just started cleaning the dishes from breakfast and with nobody asking her. And I was just like, wow, like, does that happen? You know? And the mom said, like, you know, it doesn't happen every day, but you know, she's 12 and she should know what to do. And she knows that if there's dishes, she should clean them. And I was just so taken by it because, like, you know, like I said, like just the idea of getting me to clean my room when I was little was like, you know, very hard for my mom. And so that's really kind of where like the spark of like, well, I want to learn how to raise a child like that. And, you know, I asked the little girl, like, what did you do that? What are you doing? And she said, I want to help my mom. I love my mom. And so there was this, like, it wasn't just like, I feel like I have to. And sometimes people ask me that, well, don't the kids have to because they're poor? And there's a lot of research that shows that that's not the case, that like, this isn't about have to, this is really about the parents transmitting this value of helping your family, that helping your family makes you feel good and brings you something as well, you know, and it feels good to contribute and work as a team. And so that's where I really started off, was like, okay, what are these Maya families doing and parents doing to raise children like this? And it wasn't just this family. You can find examples of this really in the United States, Native Americans in the United States, and then all the way down in Central America as well. And you can find it all around the world. That's very well documented, that the Western society tends to raise these very unhelpful children, and many cultures raise these very helpful children.
It's wild because, like, even, you know, my grandparents would have talked a lot about how, you know, what their generation would have just worked as children. Yeah. They didn't see it as work. It was like you were just part of the functioning of a household that often had like a small holding of chickens and maybe the donkeys, and, you know, they had to be fed, and there was jobs, lots of jobs, and they were
yes.
part of that daily work. And
yes.
if there was a farm, they were working, they were up milking the cows before they went to school. Like my children's grandfather had to milk cows before he went to school every day and then walk to school. And I don't think anyone was making him do that. I think it was just part of what life was like.
That's right. And I think, you know, around the Industrial Revolution, children started to be exploited, right, in terms of like working in factories and having these very hard jobs. And so there became this shift in our society to think that, you know, a children's role is to play, not to work. And so there was this very big shift. But I think what happened, clearly we don't want to go back to children and they're working in the factories and not playing, but the Maya kids play, these kids play, there's tons of time to play. I think we've gotten rid of all of their work, right? And we call it work, it's like chores, it's help around the house, it's getting things done. And I think children, there's a lot of good evidence scientifically that children need to contribute to feel good. That, you know, human children are incredibly helpful. They're born this way. And this is probably what made us successful as a species. And when we say, okay, your job is to play, we take away this huge purpose and meaning in their lives, you know? And I think children need that. They need to feel like they have a purpose in their family, that what they do matters to their parents, that they contribute. I mean, not like a week goes by, I don't get an email from somebody saying, you know, I allowed my kid to help with dinner tonight and she was so happy about it. And she was so, I mean, somebody yesterday told me this on a podcast, you know, she loves helping me cook dinner. She loves it. And it's like, children want to help you. It's just that we push them away. So there's a wonderful study showing European American families where the mom actually says, I push them away. You know, they're too young to help when they're two or three or four. I tell them, go play outside. So we actually tell them that this is not your job. This is not your job to help. And there's data that shows that over the years, the child learns, okay, my job is to go play, right? They're not stupid. If we tell them enough for years that no, go play, this isn't your job, they're going to learn that, right? And so then they become 7, 8, 9, and you try to get them to help with the dishes and they're like, no, that's not my job. Oh. Right? So, but in many, many societies, including the Maya, the parents encourage the child to help just a little tiny bit, or come watch while I cook dinner. You know, if the fire is too dangerous for a small child, or the knives, come watch me, or here, wash these carrots, like very small, tiny tasks that they will give a very small child, but they never push them away unless they're being very, very like destructive or not behaving really well. But typically they allow the child to help a little bit in whatever they're doing. And they welcome the child to watch or be near them. And then what that happens is over time, the child sees their role as this helper, you know, and slowly grows into the task. Okay, now you're washing the carrots. Okay, now you can cut the carrots, or now you can, you know, cook the carrots. You know, it's this very slow progression. But little children want to help. Even Western European children want to help. And the idea is to cultivate that and fan that flame instead of putting it out by saying, no, go play. You know, you're going to make a mess, go play. So that's where it starts. It starts with allowing the child to do a little bit with you. You know, I say, if you're working around the house, the child should be there helping you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, or at least, you know, doing their own thing. You shouldn't be in, the child doesn't need to be entertained. And then if they come over, or ask them to come over, come help me with this. Come open the door so I can take the garbage out. Come carry this small bag of garbage, you know, like just something, just a little bit of, you know, one or two of these commands or directions, like an hour. 5 a day is all you need.
And there's what shocked me when I started doing this at home was the amount of jobs that are super easy for a toddler, even.
Yeah.
Matching socks. Kids will ball up socks and match their socks and put the socks into the sock drawer. And then they love doing it because it's like a puzzle. You find in the match, and if there's a lonely sock, what do? We have a pile of lonely socks and then we're hunting for the match. So it's, you know, you make a whole story out of it. And
they see it as play.
Yeah.
You know, they see it as like a, yeah. And it's like keeping that spirit, right? That this is play. But children, there's so much data, like psychology has focused so much on like children being happy, right? And like, oh, and like feeling happy. And this idea of like pleasure and happiness, but there's this whole other side of mental health for children and adults too, of like feeling purposeful, right? And feeling like your life has meaning and you have a purpose, you know, like at your job, if you feel like you don't have a purpose, I didn't do anything purposeful today. It's like, oh, you know, you feel bad, right? Like you want to, I think that's innate in us as humans, and children are the same. And I think that's what's missing in a lot of children's lives. And I think they feel like angst from it, and they misbehave because they are like, look at me, I want to help, you know, I want to help you. I mean, parents are the sun and the moon to children, right? That's like all they have, really. And to help a person that you love that much feels so good. You see it on their faces, right? When they're like, look what I did. And you're right, it doesn't have to be much. I mean, I remember when Rosie, when we first started, was like two or three. And you know, I'd be cleaning up the living room and I'd just be like, go plug the vacuum in, or go grab the vacuum, or go put this book away, right? It's just these very small things. And now she's 8, and like Saturday, we cleaned the whole house together.
Amazing.
Yeah, she was like up on the counter, like wiping everything. Like she knows what to do, and still has like a joy in it sometimes. Sometimes not, but some days she has joy in it. She told me one day, she said, I was gone out for dinner one night, and she said, you know, I was sitting around and the kitchen was kind of, the dining room table was kind of messy. And I was like, my mom would say that this is going to be fun. I'm going to clean it up. I was like, okay, I'll take that.
That's so cute. Yeah, my little boy yesterday was like, I want to do the shopping. And I was going, okay, right, okay. He's 6. And he was like, I really want to go and get a trolley and like a car to shopping cart,
yeah,
and go around the supermarket and get everything on a list. We decided we were having for dinner, made a list of things that I felt he could get, you know, and that he can reach and everything. And then I put a couple of things like canned tomatoes that I was like, he might not know where that is. That anyway, so he wrote out his list. And he went and he got the trolley, put the coin in, and off he went. And I just stalked him around the supermarket like a security guard or something.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
I watched him, and he got everything on the list, and he went up and he paid at the counter with his card.
Wow.
And he put out, and I was behind him. I was like looking at the cashier going like, I'm here. But it was like, he has not stopped talking about it all day. He was so proud of himself. And there's something about that innate, like internal locus of control as well, like,
yes,
like a sense of like, I achieved that and I feel proud of myself as well.
Yeah,
as, you know, looking for parental approval all the time.
Absolutely. And think about like what you've taught him too, in terms of like writing out the list. You know, like a lot of times Rosie will want to write things, especially when she was little, when, you know, like I'd be doing a recipe and I'd be writing it out and she'd want to do it too, and I'm like, okay, write it out. Like, and that's how she learned to write, you know. Yeah. Because that's when you learn, when you're actually like using your skills, right? And that's such a beautiful, what a beautiful, and now he has a life skills too of like paying. And I mean, there's just so much, there's so much more going on there than just getting a list of groceries, right?
Yeah. And like now he'll be able to do that as a little job, you know. So just to see his little face when he achieved it, I was like, gosh, you know, I was tempted to say no and say like, look, you're a little bit young, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, I'm going to do it. And I had you in mind because I was interviewing you today. And I was like, yes, I'm going to do it. Let him do it and see. And I was nervous, like I was following him around and hiding behind corners and going, is he okay? And he's consulting his list. It was very cute.
Oh. But that's a beautiful example of, and that would be something that you would see in many cultures, right? Where the, if the mom thinks it's a little too much, too, you know, too soon, then she'll like follow, you know, or send an older sibling to follow, or somehow modify it a little bit so that it's safer and doable. Like, I think we think it's like all or nothing. They're either ready or they're not, but there's all this kind of intermediate phases, you know? So right now Rosie's 8, and for about the last 6 months or so, she's been trying to ride her bike to piano lessons and back. But we started with like me taking her on the bike, you know, being with her and then kind of following her home. And then, you know, then we moved to like, okay, me taking her and then her coming home. And it's been this kind of very slow thing where she's now just after 6 months really doing it herself, you know? And so I think it takes away the fear of the parent, you know, but then it also empowers the child. So they're not going to fail, right? And like, they're safe. And so I love that, because you allowed him to take this risk that he, you know, this kind of risk that he saw in a way though, that was felt good for you, but also kept him kind of, you know, safe. And it's beautiful.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Inuit people that you spent time with. And some of the things that you were most struck by in the book was the emotional intelligence that was passed down. And I think that, you know, emotional literacy is a real gap. Like, and one of the things that we do in Lust for Life is we have a schools program where we're teaching emotional literacy to children. And what we're finding is there's a lot of parents going, I never got taught that. And maybe I would be able to say, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm angry. I would be feeling some kind of way and not able to like name what was going on for me or be able to even articulate it clearly, because we just it was quite a suppressed sort of environment, you know, when we were growing up.
So in the Arctic, the Inuit have, you know, again, they're like world renowned for like having this emotional regulation is like the really key thing. And they intentionally teach children this very young, but it's not about suppressing the emotion at all. Like that is not, like it's more of this emotional autonomy, actually. You can have these big emotions and these big feelings, right? I mean, I think we feel like when a child has a tantrum, it's our job to stop it immediately, right? And many parts of the world, that's not what a parent feels like. It's the job of the parent to help the child learn to then kind of settle down, right? And like through modeling, through the parent being very calm, you know, very calm, using this energy to help the child find that energy in themselves, but then also using tools like teaching positive emotions to help you calm down. This was really striking to me because, you know, it matched so much with what I was reading about in Western psychology about, you know, if you're very upset and like, we think like, okay, when somebody harms me or hurts me or something bad happens, I have to get angry, right? That anger is like this kind of automatic response to things and I don't have control over it, right? Like somebody says a mean thing to me at the grocery store, well then, and I get angry. That's what you do. Right. And what psychologists and neuroscientists are learning is that's not true, that actually emotions are learned responses to situations, and that we learn like, okay, this, our brains learn like, okay, when this happens, I do this and I have this emotion. And so we are teaching children that, right. That like somebody takes your ball, that's when you get angry. Right. And the Inuit would say, okay, somebody takes your ball, you can be upset about it, but you don't have to be angry, or you don't have to have that emotion. You can choose to have another emotion, a more productive emotion, you know, one that allows you to figure out what's going on with the ball, one that allows you to connect with the person and like change the situation. And so there is this like really, really sophisticated level of emotional intelligence that the families pass down to the children. And so by the age of like 6 or 7, the children have like more emotional intelligence than I do. It's really incredible, like how calm and unreactive kids can be to situations, and it's intentionally taught very, very early.
And I think parents that are listening are going to be going, "How? What do I do? What do I do? How do I impart emotional intelligence if I feel like I'm still working on that for myself?" Like, in,
yeah.
You know,
I know I was, I mean, before I wrote this book, I was like the most angry person. Like I would get angry. My husband would be like, "You're just like full of rage, Michaeline." I mean, like literally, because that's what my home life was like growing up. Like, you know, if I did something wrong, I was crying, I was upset, you know, it was just someone who would yell at me, you know, and like threaten me. And so I learned to just, like you say, suppress the emotion, right? And just, okay, I'm just going to be quiet because I'm afraid. You know, there was a lot of behaving because I was afraid. And so I never learned any other way of responding to people except to yell, you know, and get really mad. Like that was just the go-to emotion. So the key with children really is being calm yourself. And I know that's like, it's really hard, but it feels so good. It feels so good to learn that skill. You know, and here's the other thing I think is key in many cultures, including the Inuit, is to never take, especially small children. I mean, maybe as they get older, it's different, like teenagers, tweens, but like, you know, young children, baby to like 10, even like never take it personally. You know, like this is the, you know, I said one day to a mom in the Arctic, I said, "Well, what do you do?" Because there's these amazing stories with Arctic Inuit families where like this very famous anthropologist lived with an Inuit family for 18 months in the 1960s. in an igloo and out on the land. I mean, it's there's this incredible book that she wrote about it. And she went to write about shamanism, but then she realized the story was their emotional intelligence. And so she wrote about how they transmit it to their children. And there's this amazing scene where this, I think, 3-year-old little girl is hitting this mom in the face with the spoons, like just hitting her. And the mom looks over to the scientist, her name's Jean Briggs. And she says, you know, she has no understanding. And she's not upset at all. And like, and then there, you learn that about this idea of like no understanding. And essentially in many cultures, parents think of children as these kind of very irrational, kind of hot emotional beings that don't have understanding yet. They don't have logic. They don't have rationality. And so they act crazy and have these tantrums and just they're completely, you know, without emotional intelligence. And that's just how they are. And it's not anything to do with you as a parent, you know, it's not, you know, and it's not your job right then to like stop it, but it's your job to model how they should be. And so they never argue or yell at them because like, how can you argue with like an irrational creature, you know, that doesn't have understanding? And so that really helped me because I was taking Rosie's behavior, like when she would hit me in the face, like she would yell at me, that she would pinch me. I was taking it very personally and getting angry at her. Like, how could you do this to me? Like, why would you do this to me? Why are you hurting me? And so I was having very kind of an antisocial view of her behavior, that she was trying to hurt me. Right. And we say this a lot. We say children are pushing our buttons. Children are, you know, pushing boundaries. You know, they're manipulative, right? We have these very kind of antisocial views of their behavior. And what that does is that makes us angry at them. Yeah. Right. And so this shift in perspective of saying, she has no understanding. She doesn't understand. She doesn't understand. She doesn't know how to handle this situation and behave in this situation. It's not personal to me. Really helped me stop being so angry at her and allowed me to soften my response to her. And it took time, but I remember the first time she hit me across the face. It was after we had traveled. I think she was almost 4, and she like hit me across the face. And I looked over at my husband and I said, she has no understanding. I was trying to like channel that, you know, and I stayed calm. And I didn't get upset at her. And the look on her face was incredible. She could see that I was different and that I wasn't going to get angry at her. And she softened. She calmed down. And it was incredible because I would have yelled, why are you hitting me? Don't hit me, you know, or like got very upset. And then she would have yelled back and it would just have, you know, escalated. But because I just said, she doesn't have an understanding. She doesn't understand. The whole situation just calmed down. And it was a turning point in our relationship completely because she stopped fighting me because she could see I wasn't going to fight her. And so I just ask parents to like, just try it once, just try to think of the child as this irrational creature that doesn't have understanding, doesn't know what they're doing, and it's not personal at all to you. And just maybe even close your eyes and just be like, you know, and just let it go. Let all of it go. Your response, their whatever they're doing, and try to find this softer response to them. Because they will come down with you.
And there's loads of gorgeous neuroscience that's just emerging about mirror neurons and co-regulation and, you know,
yes,
this is all now being backed very heavily, which must delight your science brain.
Yes, yes.
This is mirror neurons. That's what was happening. We were co-regulating, like our heartbeats were syncing up in that moment.
That's right.
Literally bringing her down. So sometimes when I find myself getting, you know, triggered by my children, which happens all the time, you know, where I'm just going, like, I find my like myself getting out of a state of regulation and feeling
yes
annoyed at them or frustrated, I just go, what's my job here? And then I just think of, I need to be a mirror for them. I need to co-write
That's right.
with them. So I, my job is to be calm.
That's right. One of the moms said, like, you're the rock in their storm.
Yes.
You know, like, if you don't join, you can't, they can't calm down
don't
if you're in
the storm.
Yes, exactly. She was like, just no, you don't. So I said to one of the moms really early on, I said, well, what do you do when they push their button and they manipulate you? And I was like, you know, and she just laughed at me. And she was like, she did. I have it on tape. And she's just like, she's 2 years old. This is when she was two, my first trip up there. And she's like, she's 2 years old. She's not manipulating you. She's not pushing your butt. This is a baby. You know, she's like, she just doesn't know what she's doing. She's disorganized and chaotic, right? And like, and it was a real turning point for me too, because it was like the way I interpret her behavior, it affects my response. You know, really greatly, right? Like, if you say to yourself, she's trying her best, she's just this wild, irrational creature, you're going to have such a different response than if you say, she's manipulating me. You know, she's trying to control me.
She doesn't have a prefrontal cortex.
She doesn't have a prefrontal. That's right. Exactly. She doesn't. There's just no way. These are just myths we've told ourselves about children that our society has passed down. And, but you're exactly right. That is your job. Your job is to show her how to calm down, you know, and when you see it work, which I saw many times with Rosie up in the Arctic, I think that's why I could do it maybe right away, is because I saw it. And as a parent up there, you see it all the time. The parents calm, the child calms down. You know, the parent doesn't say anything. Maybe the parent touches the child. This is a very underutilized tool of just, you know, young children, they don't have prefrontal cortexes, but they also don't have a lot of language understanding or usage of it, right? So if we just keep talking to them, we're only escalating it, right? Because they don't know what we're saying. But if you just touch them, you know, all of that changes their nervous system, right? A slight touch, you know, quiet and just touched. I remember Rosie would get really upset in the back of the car while I was driving. She'd be screaming, you know, and the old me would like, oh, be quiet, you know, da, 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 what's wrong? Are you okay? You know, all these words. And then I just, the new me would just reach back and touch her leg, you know, and just and immediately she, you know, in a calm touch, and immediately she calmed down, you know, and sometimes I would say like, I'm on your team, or just a very like, you know, just very, very small words. So that, I think the key things are changing your perspective of their motivation, right? Give them the benefit of the doubt. Like they're trying their best, you know, and there's actually an Inuit word for that means we're both trying our hardest.
Oh
yeah. And it's a, I don't know what the word is. I always forget it, but like, I try to think of that, like she's trying, you know, it's the opposite of like manipulating me. She's trying her best. And she will calm down, and it will change. Rosie changed in months. It was months. She went from like tantrum every day to like, you know, tantrum every month.
Wow.
She just needed me to be calm. Like you said, she needed me to do my job.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And just to touch on then, I suppose the Hadzabi community.
Yes.
Because you talk a lot about how they fostered like good, strong mental health in their community. And you know, I think the parents listening to this have probably either themselves struggled with anxiety, depression, you know, or because that's how they maybe came to follow A Lust for Life, either themselves or maybe their children have. And, you know, I think we're seeing pretty high levels of anxiety and depression in young people in Ireland. So there's this study called the My World Survey that is undertaken by UCD University College Dublin every year with a mental health charity called Jigsaw, and they basically take the temperature of the mental health and well-being of 12 to 18 year olds in Ireland. And the last My World survey showed a significant increase from the one before, but there was almost half of the like young people, I mean their children 12, so surveyed said that they had struggled with severe to very severe anxiety or depression, which is kind of terrifying. And I think we've a lot of parents coming to us going, Oh my God. And they're so anxious about their child's mental health.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's scary. I mean, I think I to say that in the book that like that's what I worry about too. Like, you know, I always thought like, oh, I want my child to go to Harvard and do all these amazing things. And then as I was writing the book, I was like, no, I just want Rosie to feel good mentally, you know, because that's the heart, what we struggle with as a society right now, right? So, I mean, to me, it's very obvious when you travel that a key thing to this anxiety problem and epidemic is this lack of autonomy. And you know, there's a lot of data on the psychology side of things showing that, so autonomy is this kind of this complex idea of like feeling like you're in control of your life. You know, you have control of like what you do, kind of moments where you have control of what you do and you have control of your choices and you move about freely in your environment without feeling like you're constantly being controlled, but you're connected to people. So you have like a connection to people. You help people, you're kind, you're generous, you're respectful. So you have this freedom and this independence in some ways, but it's kind of also contained in some ways because you have this connection to your family. And there's a lot of data that shows that a lack of that really increases a child's risk for anxiety and depression because we feel anxious when we feel out of control of our lives, right? When we feel like we don't know what's going to happen, right? That's a big source of anxiety. What's going to happen? And then if you look around, and I don't know the numbers in Ireland, but in America, like children have very little autonomy,
Yes.
right? They wake up in the morning, they get ready for school, they go to school, they come home, they go to some class, they do their homework. Like there's just very little room for them deciding and managing their time, right? And so I think if you, to me, as a, it's like if you, there's one thing you can do to help your child with anxiety is that's have, almost, you know, start off with weekly, but like go to daily times when they are autonomous. And I think it's hard because I think we don't know what that looks like. You know, we don't see it. I didn't know what that looks like. I thought I was giving Rosie autonomy. And then when we went and traveled in Tanzania and I actually saw what, like, I mean, in every place we traveled, children had it, but I really focused on it in Tanzania and really saw what that looks like, how that parent-child dynamic looks when a child is autonomous. It's totally different than what I thought. And I talk about in the book this idea of like, how often do you tell a child to do something? You know, like I actually recorded myself with Rosie one night and like counted like how many instructions I was giving her. Because every time you instruct her, you're controlling her path, you're controlling her life. And I think I was doing something like over 100 in an hour. Like it was just a constant stream of like, don't do that, don't do this, go over here, say this. You know, it was like, and whereas like in the Hadzabe, the parents were saying like two or three things in an hour. So like, you know, almost 100 times less. And what that does is it totally changes the child's life. The other thing is it does is it reduces conflict, right? Because every time you tell a child what to do, you're running the risk of them getting angry because they don't want to do it, right? Or you getting angry because they don't do it and they ignore you, right? Like, so what I started doing was when Rosie and I were getting really conflictual, like in the mornings before school or at night before bedtime, I would do this. I would have my watch and I would say, okay, I'm going to get one command in 20 minutes. I get to tell her to do one thing in 20 minutes, 20 whole minutes. And it's hard. It's really hard. But it works. It works amazingly well. You find out you don't need to tell children these things. You don't, like you said, like your little boy knew where to get all the things. They know what to do. And every now and then I still do it. I'm like, because it takes practice and it's like, but watch other parents too. You'll see they're just this endless stream of commands to a child. And I think that makes children so anxious because I would feel anxious. I feel anxious when people are telling me what to do all the
Yeah,
time, you
same.
know? So it's like, why would our children want that?
Yeah, it's amazing. And like that really changed. I mean, I just tried to shut up. I just try and stop
Yes.
talking so much. And like what you were saying about using physicality. So like
Yeah.
instead of saying, even if I need my child to go out the door, sometimes I'll just put my hand on their shoulder and guide them instead of going, go out the door now, put on your shoe. Like I try and just like hold them and bring them with me. And even that just like brings them down a notch.
Yes.
Then like sometimes just yappy yappy, it just stresses them out.
Yeah, it just sounds like wah, wah. I mean, I think to little kids, all that talking is just like wah, 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 wah.
Yeah,
You
just like
know?
wah la la la.
Yeah, like
Yeah.
I talk about in the book, like when it was bath time in the Arctic, the grandma just went and ran the bath water. And
Amazing.
then the kid came. I was it was amazing. Could the kids take in a bath, you know? It's that
It's
easy.
kind of like walking around going, it's time for your bath, come on, take off your socks, take off your pants, take off your t-shirt,
Yeah.
everything.
Exactly. Of course, the
Oh,
kid knows all that stuff. They know
yeah.
the vet, you
They
know,
know
like
the
they're.
order in which they know how to take off their clothes if they're like three, you know, like they can do it.
Yeah.
So funny. And like one of the things that really has been like a watchword for me since reading the book as well is about control, you know, and you mentioned that. You know, am I trying to control here or am I cooperating? Can we work on something together? Like if we want to go to the pool, say, and I go, okay, and instead of going, right, now you need to put on your shoes, where's your swimming togs and where's your towel? And get this and get that. It's like, okay, guys, we're going to the pool. What do we need to do to get to the pool? Like,
I love that.
let's get there together, you know, and but it's a reframing that it's like we are all pointed in the direction of the pool. So like how do we make it happen together?
It's not your job to like, kids don't want you to be like, you know, they want you to treat them more maturely,
Yeah.
right? And that's what you're doing. You're saying, you're capable of this. Let's do it together. You're on my team, right? You're not just this little robot that can't do anything. You're a highly capable human being. I love that. I'm going to
Yeah.
start saying that.
So can you just explain before I let you go, because I realize we're almost out of time, your model of team parenting? So this is like
Yes.
distilling all of like the what you learned on your travels down to like looking at how we can sort of be not a helicopter parent, not a free range parent,
Yeah.
but somewhere in the middle that kind of takes the best of everything you learned.
Yeah, and I think you just summed it up. Like we all want to go to the pool. Let's work together. You know, that's what the team parenting thing is about for me. It was like I want Rosie to be on my team, and I want to be on Rosie's team too, right? Like and so I came up with this, and actually you see these elements, this team elements all over the world. And I'm sure in Ireland it wasn't very long ago where you saw them. But the T is for together, like doing things together. It's not about teaching the child to do things by themselves. Children don't want to do things by themselves. They're not, especially little children, they're not made for that. They're made to even just have you there, you know? So it's like if a child is struggling to do something, let's say, let's do it together. You know, like Rosie needs to do something, let's do it together. Can we do it together? And so always thinking that way, because in our society, we think they need to be independent, right? And they need to do things on their own. And we're fighting their natural instincts of being doing things with other people. They are social, we are social creatures to the core. And so that's T is for together. And then E is this idea of like encouraging children instead of controlling what you were talking about, right? Like saying, what do we need to do to get to the pool? That's like guiding and encouraging them to get ready, right? Instead of like controlling them. Because when we try to control children, we create anxiety, but we also create resistance, right? And we really, in our society, we really view parenting as like the parent tells the child, the parent knows, and the information comes from the parent to the child, right? And this other view of like encouraging is like, okay, I have some ideas for you, but I want you to kind of come about the answer on your own as well. So asking questions, like you said, like what do we need to do? Or getting the child to think, telling the child the consequences. You know, if you climb on that tree or that wall, you're gonna, you know, what's gonna happen? Or you're gonna fall, you're gonna hurt yourself, right? Instead of pulling them off or telling them. So E is for this idea of like learning to encourage children's behavior versus like controlling them. And I think that helps a lot with anxiety too, because then the child feels like they're making the decision, they're in control of their life, right? So A is for autonomy, which is we've talked about, which is this huge, children in Western society just are craving it so much. Like I say, like start an hour a week, go to a park, somewhere where the child can just roam and do what they need to do. And you can keep an eye on them and just let them be autonomous for an hour, three commands in an hour, and see how that changes their behavior and their mental health. And then M is for minimal interference. So that's this idea that like you're saying, like, shut up.
Just shut up.
And watch, yeah. You know, watch. Like, you can't learn about your kid and what they're interested in and what they can do. Like, you watching that your child at the grocery store like that, you learned what he could do.
Yeah.
Right?
Shocked.
Like, I think many parents will be shocked if you just sit back and watch. You can jump in if they're going to, like, catch something on fire or, like, you know, hurt somebody. But just watch them and interfere only when you, like, absolutely need to, you know? And kind of, like I say, instead of being the director of the movie, be, like, the person in the background, just the stagehand, you know? Like, the assistant that's just, like, letting the scene unfold and only jumping in when really you absolutely have to, you know, that they're going to get hurt or if you feel like they need help. And then even having a soft touch.
Yeah.
So instead of like kind of thinking the more you do as a parent, the better. That's was always my thinking. The more I say, the more I do, the better. It's kind of the opposite. It's like, how little can I do? You know, and this I think will help with anxiety too. Right. Because yeah. this is really autonomy. And this is where children gain that confidence. Like your little boy. I did it. Look what I did. You know,
I love the word facilitator, you know, that you're there to make things easy for them.
Yes.
To help them to be able to find their own path. You midwife them through an experience rather than direct, you know, you see that they have the potential to be able to do this. And then you stand back, and if they need you, you can scaffold it through.
You're right.
But, you know, start off with the assumption that they'll get it.
Yeah. And sometimes I even ask Rosie, it's like, can you do this? You think you can do this? You know, because they know, especially as they get a little older, they know. Like, he knew he could do that at the grocery store, you know? And the more they are allowed to try, the more they understand what they can do, right? And so I love that. You are the facilitator, right? You're there to give help, and they're facilitating you. You know, they're there to help with the kitchen, you know, and like with the cleaning, and like it goes both ways, right? Instead of just one direction. So,
Michaeline, can you tell us anything about your new book? Because you said you're working on a new book. I'm like, what is it?
So it's the opposite. It's about dopamine in children's brains. And screens and food and these things that I think control our children in many ways, control us or control our lives. And it's about how understanding how they work so that we can kind of take back the control over them.
That sounds like a very necessary book for our time. I'll definitely be picking up a copy.
It's been such a pleasure. Your insights and comments are just, I learned a lot. So thank you.
Thank you to all our listeners for joining us for this parenting podcast at A Lust for Life. We are committed to providing free, valuable resources and support to children and young people and families like yours, but we can't do it alone. If you found our podcast helpful and informative, please consider supporting our work by making a donation. To donate or learn more about our school's programs or campaigns, visit alustforlife.ie. Every donation, no matter how small, helps us reach more children with our early intervention programs in schools. Join us on the journey to change the face of mental health in Ireland. Thanks for listening.